You know, we all the time we talk about things that we know. We know this, we know that, and so on. But what does it really mean to know something? And how do you know what you know is correct? These can bring in some pretty difficult questions, and that's what I want to look at today. The fact is, I have very logical reasons for believing in things that logic and reason cannot teach me. It's kind of ironic, but the more complexity science finds in life, the more unlikely becomes the whole scenario and theory they use to explain the origins of life. The amazing thing that quantum physics shows is that nature, at its most fundamental level, strains human credulity and belief in ways that biblical faith never does. Hi, Cliff Goldstein here. Welcome to the program. You know, what I want to do is I want to do a little experiment with you. And I want to do it with my computer. Now, if you look on the computer, if you could see it here, I have a folder. It's called self-referential. Now, what I'm going to do, I'm going to open the folder. Okay, I'm going to open it. And as you see, we have a drop-down menu. So far, so good. Open up a folder called self-referential drop-down menu. Now, I want you to see what happens here. I am going to take this folder icon, self-referential, and I'm going to put it in its own drop-down menu. Look at this. What happened? It won't go in. Let me try it again. It won't go in. Now, come on, I'm putting it in. It won't go in, and I keep trying. And, folks, I think you could probably try to put this in till the cows go home, and you can't put the folder in its own drop-down menu. You know, you can't drag any folder into itself because that's basically what you're doing here. Now, before I came on here and did this, I went and I asked some computer geek, and I says, is there any possible way to drag an icon, this icon, into its own drop-down menu, basically drag the icon into itself? And because I was curious, I don't want to sit there and say it's impossible to do it and then have some smart aleck computer guy tell me you can. And the answer he gave me was fascinating. I said, can I pull this folder into itself? And he said, you can, but he says, only if the software were corrupted. Only if the software were corrupted, in other words, if it was working logically and rationally and mathematically the way programs should work, it would be impossible to put the folder into itself. Why not? Well, let's think about this for a moment. Think about this. Can a scale weigh itself? How does a scale weigh itself when it itself is what is doing the weighing? Well, it can't. And in a similar way, how can you take a folder, which is kind of a set, and put it in itself? In other words, think about this. What do you do when what you want to put it in is the same thing that what you want to put in it? How can you put the container X into the container X when the container X is what you want to put into the container X? Think about this for a minute. The point is, you can't. It's logically impossible, which is why I found my computer friend's answer to be so interesting and really very profound. The only way you could put the folder self-referential into the folder self-referential is if the software itself were corrupted, if the normal logical mathematical functions were corrupted. Now, why do I find that so fascinating? Well, for starters, this simple little experiment with the desktop is an object lesson in what is known as epistemology, the study of knowledge. I've talked about on this show a bunch of times before. It means, what do we mean by knowledge? And I keep coming back to this because I believe it's crucial, even fundamental. In fact, in many ways, I think epistemology is really the foundation of all philosophical endeavors. In many ways, it's truly first-order knowledge. Everything else that we know or think we know stems only from our epistemology, which is the study of what does it mean to know something. Now, please understand, and I've said this before, epistemology is not the study of what we know. Biology, math, physics, history, religion, literary criticism, and so forth. No, it's the study of what we mean when we say that we have knowledge about biology or math or physics or religion or whatever. How do we come to know the things that we know about these topics or the things that we think we know about them? What are the methods that we use to come to our knowledge or our belief about these things? And how valid are they? Not our beliefs about biology and history and math, at least not directly, but how valid are the, what I would call the epistemological tools or the methods we use to come to those beliefs about these things? You know, we're not talking about, you know, what we believe about leptons, for instance, but we are talking about how we come to know what we do about them or think, at least think that we know, which leads to a similar kind of conundrum that we just looked at when we saw our desktop experiment. Think about this. We want to study knowledge, how we come to know something. But this leads to, I'm afraid, a pretty much an unsolvable problem, pretty much like the unsolvable problem here. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, let's say, for instance, what do I have here? I want to study bees, okay? So I study bees. I bring my epistemological tools to the study of bees, okay? But what do we do when we want to study the epistemological tools themselves? Not just on bees, but the epistemological tools we use to study just about anything. Now, here's the problem. How do we study what it means? Listen to this. How do we study what it means to know something when the very thing we use to study how we know something is the very thing that we are questioning to begin with? For instance, I want to do a study on tea leaf reading. I want to know, what are the reasons for belief in tea leaf reading? Can tea leaf reading really give me knowledge about the world, about the future, and on and on? I want to study this. Okay, fine. I bring in some outside things to study it. Well, you know, statistics, science, reason, empirical datum, etc. That's fine. But the one thing I'm not going to do, if I'm serious about learning the truth about tea leaf reading, is to judge it solely by tea leaf reading itself. In other words, what I am not going to judge the validity of tea leaf reading by appealing to the methods and presuppositions and techniques of tea leaf reading. Of course not, because they are the very things that are being questioned, examined, and maybe even challenged to begin with. Okay, that's fine. That's reasonable. That makes sense. But let's not talk now about tea leaf reading. Let's talk about epistemological tools, the very things we use to study whatever it is we know or think we know. Listen to this point. How do we study the methods of knowledge when the very things we are using to study them, the methods of knowledge, are the very things that we are questioning to begin with? For example, central to any kind of study of anything is logic and reason, right? I mean, I don't care if you're doing the most intense experimental science, if you're doing theology, if you're doing literary criticism, whatever. You will, at some point, perhaps at every point, employ reason. Reason is kind of the uber ultimate epistemological tool, okay? But here's the question. As we saw, if we want to study tea leaf reading, we are going to have to get outside of tea leaf reading and bring to bear upon it various epistemological tools, which will include, above and beyond perhaps everything else, reason. If you were going to do a scientific look at tea reasoning, whatever the science taught you, you'd have to filter and analyze the data using, of course, your reason. I mean, reason comes to bear pretty much one way or another in anything we have to do with knowledge. Fine. Capiche. Makes sense. But what happens when we want to study reason itself? If reason is an epistemological tool, and we want to study epistemological tool, and reason is the chief epistemological tool, how do we get outside of reason in order to study it? See, again, we can get out of tea leaf reason and use reason to look at that. But what do we do when we want to examine reason itself? We almost always apply reasoning to whatever we do, which is fine. But how do we get outside and beyond and kind of above reason in order to know that our reasoning is solid? How do we, in a sense, step back from reason? How do we get out of reason as we would get out of tea leaf reading in order to validate it, to make sure it is correct? I guess the question is, what can we use to judge reason other than, well, reason, which sounds as absurd as judging the validity of tea leaf reading by tea leaf reading itself? How can we get kind of a pickle, really, isn't it? How do we examine and judge reason when the very tool to judge it, reason itself, is what is being questioned to begin with? That's being questioned in the first place. Look at it like this. In order to study a topic, you often go to something even more fundamental that you're studying, something that is built on grander and broader and more foundational principles, and then see how well the topic you are studying kind of fits into that scheme. Well, you'll see what I mean in a second, okay? How does it fit in the scheme of those things? How well do those foundational principles explain what is going on at the upper level? What do I mean? Well, for instance, I recently read that the sun produces more energy in 1 second than humans have used in all known history. So let's say I want to start studying why the sun heats up the earth so nicely. Well, sooner or later, you get into chemistry, specifically the action of hydrogen, since the sun is mostly hydrogen. There's a lot of hydrogen there, and it has a gravitational pull that they say creates a tremendous amount of pressure at the core. This leads to nuclear fusion. You get into EMC squared and so on, into the atoms itself, into the nucleus and so forth. You might even get into things like quarks and color force. I don't know how far down they go. The point is, in order to study something, we have to get into the principles behind it. To understand why the sun heats the earth, we end up with something as basic and fundamental. We get into something as basic and fundamental as basically particle physics. I mean, if you want to study nutrition, if you want to know why apples are good for you and pork fat back is bad, okay? You get into anatomy and physiology. You look at the human body as a whole. Then you get into the organs. Then you get into the cells. You get into biology. Then you maybe get into food chemistry. And then maybe you get down to the level of atoms. Again, what you're first studying was something much narrower, the health benefits of apples as opposed to pork fat back. But the next thing you know, you're into something more fundamental, more foundational, something upon which the edifice of your study rests. And if we're going to do this in order to, and we are doing this in order to understand something, to come to a knowledge about it. Now, of course, this kind of reductionism that we just looked at doesn't work with everything. I mean, if you want to study Van Gogh's, one of my favorite paintings is Vincent Van Gogh's Wheat Field with Crows. I mean, you can, I suppose, if you wanted to, get into the paint chemistry and get into the molecular structure of the paints and the canvas and so on, though I don't think that's going to be very fruitful in helping you understand the power of Van Gogh's painting. Nevertheless, the question is this. How do we apply the same methodology as we did with the sun, as we did with nutrition, with the study of reason itself? How do we do that? Well, someone could answer, well, we don't. We don't apply the same methodology. Okay, maybe, but not precisely. But what about the principles behind whatever methodology we use, that we're using, that of seeking to understand the broad foundation, the principle upon which it rests? Do we do that? How do we do that? But here's the question. How do we do that with logic and reason? You know, you could open up any primer on formal logic, and you could learn the basics of logic, modus ponens, modus tollens, the hypothetical syllogism, the law of non-contradiction, the law of excluded middle, and on and on and on. Fine. But again, upon what structure are these built? What are the reasons we have for believing in them? Now, notice how I just expressed that last question. What are the reasons for believing in these laws of reasons? That is, what's the problem here? I'm going to use reason to study reason? Huh? Isn't that kind of question begging? Are we not in a vicious circle here? Are we not, in a sense, assuming what we're trying to prove? Well, you say, we use our senses to see that some of these things are true. Okay, we use our senses to prove these things are true. We use our senses to prove logic. Maybe I'm missing something here, but I always thought the whole point of logic was to get us to truths that were beyond the senses. I mean, come on, our senses sure can dupe us, can't we? I mean, I say, for example, I say that there are 5 Bulgarians in the room next door. Fine. I can always go into the room next door and look. And if I see 5 Bulgarians in there, great. But maybe 1 Bulgarian is hiding from me in the closet. Thus, my senses are not giving me the truth, are they? Now, on the other hand, if I say that if there are 5 Bulgarians in the room next door, there are more in the room than if there were only 2. Someone says, well, let me go in and check. Well, that's ludicrous. I don't need to go in and check and see. Of course not. Pure logic alone tells me that if there are 5 Bulgarians in the room next door, there are more in the room than if there were only 2 Bulgarians in the room next door. Also, technically, am I not using logic when I look in the room and see only 4 and decide that I'm wrong, that there are not 5 in the room? And with the other example, when I say that there are 5 in the room, there are more than if there were only 2, am I not using logic and reason again? But here's the problem. How do I get behind logic and reason to understand if it's correct? How can I do with these epistemological tools as I did with the study of the sun? Or bees? How do I get behind them as I did with the sun or nutrition or and so on and look, do that so I can look at the basis and foundation of that logic? You know, is there some kind of metalogic, some form of truth outside of logic which we can then from outside view and look in? Should we be able to do that? I mean, how do I know our logic and reason is any good? How can we judge it? What is the criteria and standard we use to judge it? And whatever standard that was, would it not at some point entail logic, the very thing that we are questioning to begin with? So can you see the problem? Can you see the problem here? You know, I like what author Thomas Nagel has to say about this question. He framed it like this, and I like that. He says about this, he says, one possibility is that some things can't be explained because they have to enter into every explanation. Let me repeat that. One possibility is that some things can't be explained because they enter into every explanation. Isn't that interesting? You can't explain something, let's say logic, for instance, because logic is the very thing that is needed in every kind of explanation. It comes back to that early example that I used. How does a scale weigh itself when the very thing, when it is the very thing it's used for weighing? Or how do you put the icon in the drop-down menu when the very thing you want to put in it is the same thing that you want to put it in? Or it's sort of like this. How do you define a word itself when you use word to define, when you use words to define them? How do we get past language itself in order to understand language? But isn't whatever we use to understand language still going to be language? There has been what they've called metalinguistics. And it's just sort of, you know, it's kind of some sort of linguistic field in an attempt to create some sort of linguistic field in which you could kind of step out of language and examine it. You know, I don't know how much about it or how fruitful it's been, but whatever they created would, in a sense, with metalinguistics, still be a kind of a language. And secondly, what was created only through the use of the very language itself that it was purporting to study. So I'm not really sure how valid or objective metalinguistics could be to begin with. Now, to return to my tea leaf reading analogy, I am going to create, using tea leaf reading, a new system in which I'm going to judge tea leaf reading. That is, my new system is going to be based on tea leaf reading. I mean, that's better, I suppose, than trying to judge tea leaf reading from within tea leaf reading itself, but I'm not sure how much better. Maybe, though, this is ultimately what we're dealing with. To use the analogies above, when we broke down nutrition in the heat of the sun into what we did when we broke down nutrition in the heat of the sun into particle physics. You know, for now, quarks and so forth are about as far back as we could go. And maybe that's the same with logic and reason. They are as far back as we could go. If that's true, then does that mean that there's nothing further back? You know, the very word atom itself means indivisible. It was supposed to be the bottom line. That was the whole idea of atoms. They were indivisible. They were the smallest thing. Well, we know that that is not true. The atom is made up of much smaller things. And if string theory is true, or now they're talking about M theory, the atom is almost like a teeny little universe in contrast to the smaller entities, for lack of a better word, that make it up. But maybe though, logic and reason are the same way. Maybe logic and reason is far back as we can go. Or maybe not. The fact that we can't get behind them doesn't mean that there isn't anything behind them. We just can't get there, at least for now. And it's not easy, really, if you think about it, to see how we could get behind them. Because again, whatever explanation we would use, whatever thing we would try to use to get behind them would, I would guess, entail logic and reason. And hence, we're right back where we started from. We've gone in a circle. And what happens is, I think, is that with logic and reason, we push things back until we come to what we deem as universal, necessary, and certain. Truths that cannot, it seems, be questioned or challenged. And so we have to stop there. But, you know, we hear this phrase, I've heard it before, truths that are universal, necessary, and certain. Well, that's pretty cool truths, don't you think? They're universal, necessary, and certain. But how do we judge? How do we judge that they're universal and necessary and certain? Are they the kind of things that everyone automatically agrees are true? And if popular consensus is popular consensus how we determine what absolute truth is? If everyone agrees that something is universal, necessary, and certain, is it? Plus two, I don't really want to get into this right now because that's a whole other talk. But the very concept themselves, universal, necessary, and certain, really, and to a certain degree, imply a subjective consciousness to even conceive of the idea of universal, necessary, and certain, which itself is fraught with a whole bunch of epistemological problems. Let me give you one example. I think of the famous words of the American Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident. though we're not quite dealing with the same thing as I'm talking about, it is similar. What are the self-evident truths? They said, one, that all men are created equal. Self-evident? You've got to give me a break. I mean, I know Aristotle didn't think that that was true, and Aristotle was a pretty smart guy. Then it goes on, another self-evident truth, that men are created, that are endowed by their creator with unalienable rights. Well, that self is filled with a whole lot of presuppositions. What are these rights? Life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness? This is laughable. I mean, I'm not questioning that people should have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, but to call them self-evident truths, they might be, but they are hard. They might be truths, but they're hardly self-evident and unalienable. The pursuit of happiness? Well, come on, give me a break. You know, that doesn't, to call that a self-evident and unalienable right? Let's try something a little more analytic. The law of excluded middle says that P is either true or false. Or put differently, either P is true or its negation, not P, is true. But P and not P cannot be both true at the same time. I mean, that's simple enough. Either P is true or not P is true, but you can't have P and not P true at the same time. Makes sense. Well, for a long time that did. But with the advent of quantum physics, the question is suddenly much more muddled. In the quantum realm, things seem to exist and don't exist at the same time. It sometimes appears that P is true and at the same time, not P is true. The bottom line, where am I going with all this? I guess the bottom line here is what I've often said before on the show. There is a certain level of contingency in whatever we know. That no matter what we know, no matter what we believe we know, no matter what we think we know, there is a certain point where we have to stop, that we have to reach out on and take it on faith. The bottom line, again, in all that we know, even things that we are certain about, a level of contingency and doubt exists. It doesn't mean that reality itself is continue. It means only that our understanding of it must be taken to a certain degree on faith, right? Isn't that reasonable? That's a reasonable conclusion. Reasonable. Think I made a reasonable argument? You would think so. But here's the problem. Since the whole idea of reason is what we're looking at, is what we've been questioning, and I've been challenging, how do we know what we know is reasonable? Since I've been challenging that, to say that it's reasonable, we're kind of right back where we started from. So my point is, in the end, we need to live by faith more than we realize.